Aquaculture and You, Creating a Sustainable Resource. A production of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. The Blue Revolution. Following the Second World War, human populations increased at an unprecedented rate, and the pressure on the world's fisheries grew quickly as well. Many of the most productive fishing areas began to see decreasing catches. New diesel-powered fishing fleets equipped with sonar put to sea in the mid-20th century, taking all the chance out of finding and catching ocean fish. Crashes in formerly robust fish stocks were causing fisheries managers to look with concern at the future. Consequently, across the world, interest and activity in both freshwater and marine aquaculture reignited. We would need much more time and many more podcasts to tell you about all these various developments, so we will concentrate our discussion chiefly on advances in the United States. As the series goes on, we'll begin to narrow our focus to the Wisconsin region and the exciting expansion in aquaculture happening there. We noted in the previous podcast that during the 1930s and 1940s, considerable resources had been devoted to the study and promotion of rearing catfish in the South, and subsequently, Auburn University came to be a leader in freshwater aquaculture. Interest in catfish raising continued to rise, and experimental government fish farms in Arkansas and Alabama were joined in 1965, together with other regional facilities, to form the U.S. Warm Water Fish Cultural Laboratories. Catfish farming industrialized and spread in the 1960s. Consumer demand for catfish boomed in the 1980s and 90s as well, and catfish production peaked in 2003 at 662 million pounds. Today, catfish is the sixth most popular fish in terms of consumption in America. Catfish farming is America's leading aquaculture industry, centered mostly in Mississippi, Alabama, and Arkansas. In 2010, though, only 472 million pounds of catfish were produced, and taking up this shortfall has been 138 million pounds in frozen catfish imports, up from only 10 million in 2002. With prices being paid to catfish producers on the rebound, however, things are starting to look up again for this important freshwater aquaculture resource. Another southern delicacy produced through aquaculture is crawfish. Starting in the 1950s, farmers began to regularly reflood rice fields after harvest in order to raise crawfish to supplement wild catches. Though the industry took a big hit due to the hurricanes in 2005, by 2010, the crawfish harvest in Louisiana totaled nearly 111 million pounds of pond-raised crawfish, worth more than $168 million, while the wild crawfish catch totaled around 17 million pounds and sold for about $13 million. Limited harvests of farmed crawfish occur in other southern states, such as Arkansas, South Carolina, and Texas, where they are a popular item at southern-themed restaurants and Cajun festivals. Though crawfish remains somewhat a regional favorite, this significant resource is another bright spot for American producers. Though, like catfish farmers, they have to compete now with low-priced Chinese imports. Listeners might be surprised to learn that in 1967, the primary product of marine aquaculture in the United States was oysters.
Oysters, come and walk with us. The day is warm and bright. A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk would be a sheer delight.
The once thriving oyster industry had nosedived in the first half of the 20th century due to overharvesting, pollution, and introduced diseases. However, techniques developed by the Milford Laboratory at Long Island Sound had helped oyster production rebound, in particular, cultureless seed, which made restocking the shellfish beds much easier. American oystering methods would spread to other parts of the world, and though the famous Chesapeake oysters have not regained their abundance, Pacific and Gulf oysters are a popular cultivated marine product found in most markets today. Oyster production techniques are considered to be very sustainable, oyster farming is good for jobs, and the oyster industry has a commendably small environmental footprint.
The time has come, my little friends, to talk of other things.
In addition, American know-how on hatching salmon would prove to be essential for the many salmon ocean ranching projects that were started across the world in the latter part of the century, though the complicated story of commercial salmon raising is, for the most part, outside of our subject area. What's important for our story is that in 1963, President Lyndon Johnson created an official scientific advisory committee to implement a national program that would explore and promote the development of the products of the nation's sea and coastal water resources. A man by the name of Julius Stratton was made chairman of the task force, and in 1969, the Stratton Commission's report on marine science, engineering, and resources published their findings. It's an interesting time capsule of a document, and you can easily find it online if you're curious. Their recommendation for the country? Quote, "Major new efforts should be undertaken to provide the base of understanding and technology necessary to make the products of aquaculture more available," end quote. Stratton also reorganized the government's agencies involved with aquatic affairs, and in the process created a new agency within the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, commonly heard referred to in the news as the NOAA, or NOAA. This new agency formed within NOAA was named Sea Grant, as it was intended to work for the seas and coasts much like the government's previous land grant program had functioned for agricultural areas. The Stratton Commission urged that NOAA, quote, be given the explicit mission to advance aquaculture, end quote, and that both NOAA and Sea Grant should, quote, support more research on all aspects of aquaculture, economic and social, as well as technical, end quote. This became part of what was termed the Blue Revolution of the late 1960s. Proponents hoped that the Blue Revolution would significantly increase the spread of aquaculture through a dedicated program of research, development, and technology transfer initiatives, much like the Green Revolution of the same time period had successfully increased harvests and food production throughout the world. The legacy of this Blue Revolution lives on at UW's Sea Grant Institute, where we continue to support outreach, education, and research activities that nurture the growth of the aquaculture industry in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes region. This podcast is just one of many outreach efforts that we undertake every year to promote aquaculture and its products. But the formation of Sea Grant was only one factor in the Blue Revolution. Advancements in materials technology played a huge role in this first major expansion of aquaculture, and the technological marvel that drove it all was plastics. Inexpensive plastics such as PVC could be used for valves, pipes, and even entire frameworks of rafts and cages. Water and air systems could be fitted together quickly and easily, and most importantly for marine operations, they would not corrode or rust. The versatility and practicality of plastics technology made it indispensable for aquacultural operations, and it is found in virtually every laboratory and production facility today. Over the last 25 years, copper alloys have also been incorporated into aquaculture netting and caging due to their strength, resistance to corrosion, and antimicrobial properties, which inhibit bacteria and viruses and help prevent biofouling, the unwanted growth of microorganisms, algae, barnacles, and such. Yet another critical materials breakthrough in the 1960s was fiberglass, which enabled the construction of lightweight tanks that could be molded into any size or shape. Easy to clean and to transport, fiberglass tanks made the cultivation of fish a far less troublesome undertaking. Additionally, new scientific equipment became available in the 1960s that allowed fish farmers themselves to measure and monitor common water quality parameters such as salinity, pH, and dissolved oxygen. These handheld tools could be used in all sorts of working conditions and enabled aquaculturists to head off potentially disastrous situations which would have previously ruined entire harvests. Commercial fish feeds were introduced as well, and scientific understanding of the life cycles and diseases of fish were advanced and communicated to other practitioners as never before. For example, scientists receiving government backing in Japan made significant advances in successfully raising marine shrimp in the 1960s, and this knowledge soon spread to the Philippines, Indonesia, and of course, Texas. shrimp has been the number one seafood consumed in America for many years, and entrepreneurs in the late 60s scouted out many coastal lagoons ideal for shrimp farming on the shores of Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. Several large projects were started, but due to resistance from sportsmen and conservationists, American corporations soon shifted their field operations to countries such as Ecuador and Brazil in Latin America. Today, Asian nations, most notably Thailand, produce 75% of the farmed shrimp consumed in America, and overall we import over 90% of our favorite seafood. However, much like raising salmon commercially, there are many problematic aspects to shrimp farming, both in its initial development and its current practices. You may have heard of the negative environmental impacts of such farms, how they can concentrate and spread infectious diseases to wild fish, and the environmental and economic costs of feeding the stock, especially salmon, who need to eat other fish. While there are efforts to bring more sustainability to those types of aquaculture, freshwater aquaculture is a happier story. The environmental benefits of freshwater fish farming is only one of the factors that make 21st century aquaculture so promising. But before we head towards the more regionally focused episodes in our podcasts, it's fair to take a quick look at why a problematic fish such as salmon was chosen for fish farming in the first place. In the case of salmon, as author Paul Greenberg notes in his 2010 book, Four Fish, though there were, quote, most definitely better, more efficient fish out there, we simply didn't have the technology to tame those other fish. Salmon's large eggs, their responsiveness to human intervention, and a lot of applied breeding science has advanced the human-salmon relationship to a level of complexity not seen with other animals. Quite simply, we know the salmon better than most other fish on Earth. We have mapped large portions of its genome, crossed its families, and studied its life cycle intimately. Unquote. Salmon's distinct flavor added to its appeal, and initially, so did the higher prices salmon could fetch at the market. In 1980, when 1% of the global salmon output was farm-raised, that was certainly true. But as production increased, prices dropped, leading to a downward spiral so that now fish farmers have to compete on volume. Today, around 90% of the salmon brought to market in the U.S. is farm-raised rather than wild-caught, and it remains our third most popular seafood choice. While many wild salmon fisheries collapsed over the last 30 years, the fish farms stepped up and did a remarkable job in keeping American consumers supplied with salmon. But the high cost-benefit ratio that comes with farm-raised salmon still leaves much to be desired. Oh, by the way, in case you're wondering, we're getting our data about fish consumption from the National Marine Fisheries Service. And since you may be keeping score at home, we might as well give out the entire list. You can see how your own fish diet stacks up. Ready? 2010 U.S. per capita consumption by species in pounds. In the 10th spot, it's clams at 0.34 pounds. And number 9 is pangasius at 0.4 pounds. Ahead by a nose is number 8, cod at 0.46 pounds. Coming up at number 7 is crab at 0.57 pounds. Number 6 is catfish at 0.8 pounds. Pollock is number 5 at 1.19 pounds. Here comes tilapia at number 4, 1.145 pounds. Number 3 is salmon at 1.999, let's call it 2 pounds. Number 2 is canned tuna at 2.7 pounds. And ladies and gentlemen, number 1 is shrimp at 4 pounds. That's a total all species 15.8 pounds per person in the United States per year. If you're wondering what pangasius is, it's a form of catfish, but American catfish producers insist that it be labeled something else, so pangasius might actually skew catfish into the number 5 slot. Meanwhile, that sound you hear in the background is a true blue Wisconsinite upset that his fish fry favorites, yellow perch and walleye, have not made this top 10 list. That's understandable. I know they're on my list. But before we move on to how aquaculture is affecting the consumption of yellow perch and walleye in Wisconsin, let's finish up with the Blue Revolution. To sum up, the 1960s and 1970s saw a wave of expansion in aquaculture in terms of initial government and private investment, as forward-thinking people envisioned fish farming to be a blue revolution of food production that would rival the green revolution of the 1960s. A second wave of expansion followed in the 1980s and 1990s, as the aquaculture industry matured and professionalized, in many cases into large industrial organizations able to produce high-quality, substantial levels of fish groomed for commercial markets. In 2009, aquacultural products exceeded wild fish production for the first time in history. This is perhaps overdue, as wild fish stocks have collapsed in many areas, and many traditional fisheries, such as the Grand Banks cod fishery and the California salmon fisheries, have been made off-limits due to the dramatic decline in their fish populations. This blue revolution of aquaculture was not without its downsides. One of the biggest challenges to 21st century aquaculture will be the refinement of sustainable aquacultural techniques in order to establish a stable and environmentally benign industry that will be prosperous for farmers and consumers alike. We'll discover how that is playing out in future episodes. But right now, since we've been talking so much about fish and aquaculture, it's time to take a look at both. The next podcast is a short video produced by UWC Grant's John Carl called Yellow Perch for the Hungry. It will serve as a fine lead-in to the subsequent episode, What Happened to the Great Lakes Perch? Thanks for listening. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, 2012.